Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And 51551 is our text number. Joanna, good afternoon. This is a most bizarre situation. It's Love Holidays again, loveholidays.ie. As we heard yesterday, a number of stories, some of them just miscommunication, it seems, but others of people who booked their holiday through loveholidays.ie arriving at the hotel in Lanzarote or whatever to be told by the hotel, you have no booking, we haven't got any money. But your engagement with loveholidays.ie is quite different. Tell us what happened, Joanna.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good, thanks.
So this story kind of started to unfold about 3 weeks ago, nearly a month ago now.
Okay.
A group of children, my child included, him and five of his friends, had in a giddy moment decided to book a holiday. Mm-hmm. Now, these are all children, all under 18, and they were lured in by the low prices and of Love Holiday, and they stayed on course because of the easy access through the website. And they paid a deposit for a week-long holiday in the sun, basically. They did this without consent or knowledge of the parents. Mm-hmm. As far as they were concerned, that they would deal with that later on down the line when the situation kind of got, when the holiday got closer. So the holiday isn't booked in July, so they have plenty of time to work around their parents, I guess, in their head, in their simple way of thinking about it. The parents discovered that this was going on. The information was given to us in dribs and drabs from each of our children. When we decided to act on it, then I got in contact with Love Holiday. But we sat down and we analysed the information that the children had given them. So the booking is completely chaotic. The lead passenger, the email address, the home address and the bank account are all different individuals. And they were able to input that information on a booking. Mm-hmm. The date of birth that they gave the airlines was fake dates of birth, making them obviously according to whatever they're inputting, that making them legal to travel, but obviously they wouldn't be legal to travel. So I got on to contacting Love Holidays. Mm-hmm. So it started first off with phone calls to their Irish phone number, and I have to say at this point that the people on the telephone were very, very nice to deal with, and it would be unfair to depict them as being unprofessional.
So how many? Just to go back, how many were in this group of under 18s who booked this holiday?
Six
how many?
Of them.
Six of them. Okay.
Mine and five others.
Yours and five others. Did they intend to go on the holiday?
Oh, they did.
Okay, they did. Okay.
Yes, they did.
They weren't play acting in that sense?
No, okay. They did.
And to put down
the immaturity and naivety, really, that they did. They expected they could go on this holiday.
To pay the deposit.
So they needed a bank account, and they have a bank account. Among them, it's my son who has the bank account. We opened a bank account when I went down to the bank as legal guardian, and we opened a bank account together. He didn't enter into any kind of contract with the bank without consent of a parent, and we were able to do that. So he has a little job, and he gets his money paid into his bank account.
So when did you discover?
That's where they were able to.
Okay, and as you say, this began to unfold a few weeks ago. But how did you find out about it if it's all in their name and they're doing it behind your back, so to speak?
So my child had said that he was going on a holiday with a friend of his, and then obviously he was saying that it was that his friend had made the booking, and I believe then that other parents were saying that our other children, other parents were hearing that their friends had made the booking. That's the children were kind of keeping the information back from us all. We were all kept in the dark.
And what age? They're under 18. What age are they? 17, 16 or 14?
16 and 17. 16 and 17.
Okay. And was this meant to be a post-leaving cert holiday or?
No. Not even. No. Okay.
And did they not know?
No, they were spoiling themselves.
Okay. Did they not know that by putting down a wrong date of birth, which didn't coincide with their passport.
Yeah,
they weren't going to get on the plane.
So that's it. It shows the naivety and the immaturity and they're young. I won't hold it. You can't say anything about any of them. I would have done the same thing myself at their age. However, I would have had to go into a tourist office or travel agent with my passport. I wouldn't have gotten as far as these children were able to get with Love Holiday.
I understand. You know. Okay. Now, where are we now? Love Holidays took the deposit. Then you discovered they weren't acting the Egypt. They couldn't go because they were given their everything. And so, Love Holidays. Where are we now with Love Holidays?
Okay, so what happened then was once I started making contact with Love Holiday, it started with a phone call, and I wasn't named as lead passenger, I had to make arrangements with the child and his parent to come and speak with Love Holiday and assign an adult as the person who would correspond for future correspondence,
and
if you know what I mean.
Okay, so, now let's follow the money. Yeah. How much money have been given to Love Holidays and how much do they want?
Okay, so there was a deposit of €174 taken off the children on booking.
Okay.
Then there is a total of 2,320, so will be the total, but it's broken up into a schedule of 547 on the 8th of June and 547 on the 8th of July. So when I went in then I went in to cancel the booking. Mm-hmm. Once we got past the change of lead passenger, which they're not accepting, they still address me as, you know, the name of the lead passenger that they have on file, you know. So they still insist on addressing all of our correspondence to that child. So I emailed and they insisted on having a cancellation fee that if I wanted to cancel this, that there'd be a cancellation fee of €1,030.
Wow.
Yeah. So at that point then I said I wasn't going to pay a cancellation fee that it wasn't my booking. I wasn't going to pay it. Now, the boys are in a situation that they don't have consent to go. They hadn't consent to make the booking in the first place, and they don't have the money to follow through with it. So that has me then in a loop.
One of the dates you mentioned for the second, the 5:40 payment, is tomorrow.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Where does that leave us? I've asked my child to empty his bank account and not have that money available to them.
Because they would come to
have that money.
They would come to that original credit card.
Yeah. Yeah, and we also rang the bank in the hopes that they could stop it in case that he'd be charged with a direct debit or bounced back money, or you know the way sometimes banks can charge you if the account is empty.
So they want that money tomorrow. You say that it won't be found in the credit card account anyway because there's nothing in it.
Yeah.
Okay, now, and that has implications as well in terms of credit rating and all that kind of, but let, put that aside.
That's right.
If they had given their correct dates of birth, could they have proceeded with the booking? Do you follow me?
So, I do. So I think in the terms and conditions of for Love Holiday, mm-hmm. hidden in the terms and conditions, when you tick that box, you're ticking that you are over 18.
Okay.
So if they wouldn't have gotten further if they weren't faking it, their dates of birth. They weren't over 18, and by right they shouldn't have ticked the terms and conditions. The next part that where they put in the fake dates of birth, that was with the airlines. So that was at a later stage. Love Holiday had already taken the deposit at that point for them to proceed to the airlines part.
Okay, and the books, the tickets had been booked. Sorry, the airline tickets had been paid for. If you're booking them, do you follow me?
They must be paid for through Love Holiday. I don't know. There's only €174 taken out of it. That wouldn't cover the charge of the cost of five people travelling.
Five people return flights.
Let's deposit with the airlines or?
No, well, who were they going
I
to
don't
be?
Know.
Yeah. Had they got details of their flights? Times, dates, airports? I don't know. Okay.
I'm not entirely sure, but
So you're saying the only evidence when you book this, like when you book a flight with Ryanair, you have to give your passport number, etc. So there is a fallback, and Ryanair have special conditions. Every airline has special conditions for people under 16 traveling. But from Love Holidays' point of view, what more could they have done?
Well, when you get as far as airline, I believe that they should be safeguarding themselves from this scenario. In the same way that, as I said, if I went into a travel agent long ago, they were safeguarding themselves. The problem is that children have the whole world at their disposal like that in these scenarios, but they don't have the maturity. Like these boys, they didn't follow it through in their head. It was a very impulsive, immature moment. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think, that Love Holiday should definitely look for age verification early on.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, here's...
Like a proof of age.
Okay,
because they maintain to me now that they can... because of the ticking of the box of the terms and conditions, they're saying that
they're
that's their proof
in,
of them being of the age.
Okay, 51551, joe at rt.ie, 0818715815. Love Holiday basically says, when making this booking, the lead passenger on the booking and all other passengers... entered their dates of birth to reflect that they were at least 18. It has since been brought to our attention by the mother, that's one of the passengers, that's you, that the passengers lied about their ages and used a payment card without the full authority consent of the cardholder. Love Holidays pays service providers such as airlines immediately to confirm customers' bookings. This means that while the hotel on this booking is refundable, the flights are not. This situation presents exceptional circumstances, however, and we are committed to doing everything we can to support them to seek a refund from their airline. We are in touch with the passenger's mother, that's you, Joanna, to arrange the cancellation of the holiday and remain in touch to offer support throughout this process. Like, is there a danger here, Joanna, that this could get serious, like telling lies about your date of birth? When you're booking a flight, especially it's the flights I'm thinking of, the whole airline security plan, the world we now live in. But actually, well, you see, they never would have got on the plane. I don't know, what were they going to...
They wouldn't have gotten on the plane. No, they wouldn't have gotten on the plane. They wouldn't have, and they wouldn't have been able to book into the hotel.
So were they brats?
It wouldn't have gotten that far.
Yeah, were they brats or twats? If you don't mind me using it. Were they just acting the agent?
I'd say the latter.
They were twats. They were just... They thought they could get away with it.
Yeah.
Have you spoken to any of your other parents?
I have, of course. Yeah, we've had communication with this, yeah.
And are you of one voice?
Oh, we are, of course. They were just silly. They were just being silly about a chance in their arm. And I think they saw a situation in front of them that seemed to be easy to navigate. And it was. I mean, it definitely was. The Love Holiday certainly didn't provide a sort of a safeguard there for minors.
Okay.
You know, what's the difference between a 7-year-old and a 17-year-old? This could happen to any age.
So what you're saying, the proof in the pudding from your argument is that the proof of the pudding in your argument is would any other tourist or travel agent could they have got a booking on another agency? The answer is probably no.
So I don't know. I don't normally book through these package kind. It's not something, an avenue I'd go. I generally go straight to the airlines. If it were me, I couldn't say straight off if I'm booking through an airline, I have to provide my age verification, that it isn't just a case of ticking a box, something concealed in the terms and conditions. Because it was only afterwards that we saw in terms and conditions that you had to be over 18. Like at that very early point of the booking, they weren't lying about their age. They just ticked a terms and conditions box. You know, the love holiday part of the booking was just far too easy for them to get through without any kind of question, and it was when they were faced then with, you know, having to offer proof once they got to the airlines part. So it was clear then that the airlines are kind of safeguarding themselves, but at that point they were just pushing on with it.
Okay, What did you? Are these six lads? Are they contrite?
Oh, they are very much so, and they were very apologetic, and it's just once the situation was explained to them in such a way that they just weren't thinking. It was certainly naivety, and it was just like. And they're all very good boys, and you know it's not that they were acting the maggot. You know what I mean?
Did you ask them how it happened? Like with the six of them in one bedroom when all this was going on? Were they all egging
each other? I didn't go into those details with them. I don't.
Were they egging each other? Sounds like six lads egging each other on. I go on, try it, put it in, see how far we get. That place looks fantastic.
I'm sure it sounds like that. I would be like that if I were on the scene as a 16-year-old.
And I know as well that that when you Google cheap holidays, Love Holidays in Ireland, loveholidays.ie is one of the first things that comes up on your screen.
Yeah, that's right. And so where I'm at the moment now is I'm really just stuck in a loop, and I'm fuming getting all the emails in, but getting nowhere. You know?
Yeah. Anyway, that's a statement from Love Holiday. They seem to be keen to try and do something about it.
Yeah, which is great. That's great. It's great. It's great to hear. So hopefully something will come of it, and I'll get the boys will get their deposit back, and like you said, not to have credit rating affected.
Okay.
If that gets your payment, it doesn't come out tomorrow. So hopefully, fingers crossed.
Okay. And some of the language I used earlier was a bit florid. I meant, that was my understanding of the meaning of it. And it's a dictionary understanding that they were brats are annoying kids. But that's we understand it now. Okay, I hope Joanna. Well, Joanna, they're in good hands. I suspect you'll be able to sort it out. But keep in touch anyway.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks, Joanna. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Peter Cafoli, you're listening to Joanna, who's still there. Your point, please, Peter.
Hi. Well, I was just saying, I think it's typical of modern parenting. You know, the kids do wrong, and the parents expect everybody else to carry the can. I don't see why Love Holiday or Ryanair or anybody else should be out of pocket because the children lied, basically, and did, you know, did something silly.
Joanna, what do you think of that?
Well, I suppose that is that's a valid point, but I think we need to parent in terms of what we have in front of us. I mean, did the boys know it was as wrong as it was when they were doing it, or were they just chancing their arm?
Well, it's a lesson learned. I'd have them doing chores for the next 3 years to pay back the money.
Of course, and they would be, but I'm hoping that they won't have to be paying the money, because I don't believe that they should have gotten into a contract with minors anyway. But I do take on board what you're saying there, that they definitely I'll have them out on the bog. Definitely.
Yeah, but they were the ones that entered the contract. It wasn't Love Holiday's fault or Ryanair's fault or anybody else's fault. It was their fault.
That's true. But are they allowed to enter a contract as an under 18? That's the point I'm trying to make.
But they lied about their age.
Exactly the point that I'm trying to make.
But Peter, what about the age of criminal responsibility?
Well, I think the age of criminal responsibility is 12 or something, isn't it?
I thought it was around 16. But stay with us, Peter. Hugh Sheridan is a solicitor retired in Sligo.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Tell us, if you can, the legalities of this.
Yeah, well, a person under the age of 18 is considered a minor, and they are protected from contracts.
Okay.
Where they're not for a necessary, i.e., take, for example, a pair of shoes. If they go in and buy a pair of shoes and they don't pay for it, they can be sued. But if they book a holiday, they can't be sued because they're protected under the law, because going on a holiday like that is not necessary for their daily life. It's an old principle that goes back to the 1800s, where a student in Oxford bought 20 fancy waistcoats. And he was sued by the owner of the boutique. And the court held that 20 fancy waistcoats were not a necessary item for this student in Oxford. Now, I might have my basic facts wrong, but that's my recollection. So the court would not enforce a contract if Son Holiday sued the child.
So the child didn't have to pay for the waistcoats?
No, he didn't.
But if the child lied about his age...
That will be another interpretation. It will be up for the courts to have a look at that. But a child is protected against contracts under the age of 18 unless it's for a necessary item. If he tells lies, well, I don't know about that aspect of it, but I do know that a child going in and booking a holiday, it's not enforceable against him.
Okay, so in that case, sequentially say that you could argue that Love Holidays should make more stringent steps to verify the age of the person buying the holiday?
Well, yes, but that's impossible because it's all done online.
Online, exactly.
I don't know whether these kids rang up to book the holiday or did they do it online.
You could do it this morning. You just go, first of all, you Google cheap holidays, Hugh, and the first one of the first websites that comes up is loveholidays.ie. Then you go in, you put your what type of accommodation, where, what airport you want to go from, the duration, and then they trawl, and up comes 10, 20, 30 offers of accommodation in your preferred location. And then you proceed. But at no stage are you asked, can you please supply or scan in a photograph of your passport?
No, you don't. Well, that's just the new age of technology hasn't caught up with the protection of minors in the circumstances.
But you're saying the contract is not a contract for necessaries.
Yeah.
And therefore, if it's not a contract for necessaries,
it's not enforceable against the child. Now, as I said, if he goes in and buys a pair of shoes, that would be enforceable because he needs a pair of shoes. But going on holiday would be outside the scope of necessaries. It's an old legal principle going back to the 1800s. It's one of the first cases that a student would learn in the law of contract when they're in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I've dredged it back from the distant past of my memory.
But you're saying no liability can fall on a person under 18 who pretends to be over 18.
Yep.
To purchase something in terms of a contract.
Yep. Can't be enforced against them. I.e. son holidays couldn't sue the child.
It's love holidays, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
They can't. They cannot sue the child.
No.
So they take the hit for not making, for not verifying in some other way that the purchasers... And can they verify it online? Well, the airlines verify it online. Well, through the passport, of course.
I know, but you put in your passport number and your date of birth. I do not know whether airlines can backtrack and check that, whether it's accurate or not.
They also say quite clearly if there is a difference. When you're putting in your passport details, they do say be very careful, because if the passport details don't... concur with the passport you present at the airport. Well, then that's the end. Peter, do you make what about that thing? They were children, and therefore they can't be liable. They made childish carry on.
Was it Oscar Wilde that said the law is an ass?
Okay, but that doesn't okay.
Okay,
Peter. Thanks indeed. Joanna, it sounds like we're now into a pretty complicated area.
That's right. I'm glad that was brought up about entering into a legal contract there. It just shows that the reason the laws are there because minors are incapable of making adult decisions like that, you know.
Yeah.
So you, if I was to say, therefore, companies who are selling products online, they have to protect themselves against under 18s entering a contract.
Yeah, they do. But unfortunately, how can they do that with the modern way of doing things? Like you used to go into a travel agent, even 10 years ago, you went into a travel agent and the guy knew who you were.
Yeah, they'd ask for
they'd say, what's your age?
Yeah.
He might even know you to see. But nowadays, sure, you could book around the world cruise on a credit card booking.
That's true.
It's the way things are, but I can't give a remedy. You just have to take it on the chin, and it's the way it is at the moment.
And why was the student in Oxford in the 1800s buying 20 waistcoats from Savile Row? Why was he?
I don't know. I studied this 50 years ago, and I just can't remember the full details.
You've given us
food for thought, exactly,
and it sounds like a very strong legal argument.
I would advise the parents of the young fellow to clean out his account before the standing order or the direct debit comes in, because they won't stop it.
Of course not. They're not allowed. Okay. But Joanna, you've done that already, haven't you?
We have,
The case apparently, Hugh, is Nash versus Inman, 1908.
Is that it? Yes, that rings a slight bell.
Well done,
Inman's father.
John,
John Inman's father from Are You Being Served?
No.
No, I'm only joking. Okay. I'm only joking.
It concerned a minor's capacity to make contracts, as you state already, to make contracts under English law. Nash, a tailor working Savile Row, sold some cloth on credit to Inman, a minor studying at Cambridge, for what was approximately, in those days, 145 guineas. The court held that the clothing purchase could not amount to necessaries and the action must fail.
Yeah.
So basically...
I'm glad I got it right.
Yeah, you did get it right, and much to your credit. And you, well, you've a good, very strong reputation anyway. But basically, they were my reading of that is the child was acting childishly, and it's hard luck on the company that was caught that they didn't catch him acting childishly.
That's it in a nutshell.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
It's unfortunate for a vendor of a business. He just gets caught, you know. And I don't believe these people pay the airlines as soon as they get paid.
Well, I think they have to, don't they? Have to. But anyway, according to Citizens Information, that wonderful organisation here, you cannot enter a legally binding contract until you are age 18. The exception to this is contracts for necessaries, this is the point, and beneficial contracts of service which are in your best interest. What would that be for? Dental treatment or medical treatment or...
A pair of shoes.
Okay.
Okay. A shirt.
Okay.
A book that you needed for school.
Okay. Very basic. Yeah, very straightforward.
Very straightforward.
So companies who are signing the other side of the contract, i.e. a company like a travel company where there will be money owing in the ticking clock of the contract, which is the case here, they must establish beyond reasonable doubt that the person signing the contract is over 18.
And has the capacity to sign for the
capacity.
Contract.
Okay.
Yeah, because under 18, it used to be 21. It then was brought down to 18. And you're a child until you're 18 and you don't have the capacity to contract for anything like that, you know.
And does it fall within the range of the age of criminal responsibility?
It's a parallel universe, Joe. It has nothing to do
with
criminal.
Because it's civil. It's a civil case, yeah.
Pure civil.
Okay. So it's just, that's a good point. Regardless of the age of criminal responsibility, this is a civil case, and the civil case law establishes that if you are entering into a contract with someone you believe who's over 18, the onus is on you, the contractor, to actually prove that person is under 18. And if that person dupes you, well, then it's your hard luck.
It is. And that is an unfortunate ramification for the law. Like in this day and age, like you go back, as I said earlier, you go back 15 or 20 years, you'd have to go into your local travel agent and they'd know exactly how old you were by looking at you.
Yeah.
Or might even know you. Yeah.
Okay. And... Ryanair is the biggest airline nearly in the world at this stage, so there's no harm in mentioning generically. But an airline, when you give your date of birth, you buy a flight ticket, you give a wrong date of birth, but they take your money there and then. You pay for the flight there and then, and if you present yourself in the airport and your passport doesn't coincide with the booking that you've already paid for, well, then that's hard luck you.
It is. Like, you often have people who put in the wrong year by...
Yeah, I know. Or the wrong name.
The wrong abbreviation or whatever.
Okay, Mr. Sheridan, thank you so much for
your evidence from
the Sligo Circuit. And when did you retire, Hugh?
I retired in 2018.
Okay.
And I did a bit of part-time work thereafter, but I'm retired since 2018.
Well, you're hereby appointed by deed of the Broadcasting Act 1926, as amended 1972 and 2004. You're hereby appointed Attorney General to Liveline for legal advice from now on.
Well, no problem.
Yes.
I love the programme.
You're very good.
I always catch a bit of it every day.
Okay.
I wouldn't listen to the whole lot, but I catch it here and there.
Okay, onwards, Attorney General to Liveline, Hugh Sheridan, Gurra Míle Maith. Joanna, let's
take
see.
Care now. Bye-bye.
This,
bye-bye.
Thanks, Hugh. This is going to get into the law books in a good way, I hope, Joanna.
I hope so. But we're talking here about two prongs of the same fork almost. The airlines asked for a date of birth,
yes.
Right? And albeit it was a fake one they put in, where, like you said, they would be charged then to rectify it later to the day when they were going to be travelling. But they still asked. Do you know what I mean? And the airlines asked for age verification before proceeding. Okay. My issue is with Love Holidays that it wasn't as transparent. Okay. That they had gotten that they had agreed to terms and conditions, and in that it said agreeing to being over 18.
Okay. Okay. Well. Well argued, and let's see. But when are they doing the leaving cert, or are they doing the leaving cert next year? Is it?
They're not. No, they're not. No. They're
beyond
they're,
it.
They're not even there yet.
Okay. Well, that's what I mean. Are they leaving cert? Are they leaving certificate next year?
No. They're younger again. No.
Okay.
No.
In another world, they might make a million before they're all 21. They might.
Oh, they will. They definitely will. They sure will.
Once they don't break your heart in the process, but they won't. They won't. Thanks, Joanna.
No, they're great lads. Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks, Joanna. Joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Brian Joyce. Brian, good afternoon. Back to Ireland and Irish men and women in the Second World War from both parts of the island as it was then, two different states. About 64,000 from the south and similar number generally from the north, according to Richard Doherty, who's the expert on this. Brian Joyce, your father was one of these.
He was indeed. And just before we get into that, Joe, your path and mine crossed some years ago when we were both active with UPTCS, if you remember those days.
Oh, yeah, I do indeed. Yeah, the union. Yeah. Now Forza. Okay, so your father was in, joined the British Army, and where did he serve?
He served in Italy and North Africa, and then at the end of the Second World War, he served in what was called a policing action in Palestine.
Okay, and what was his wartime experience?
His wartime experience, he felt it was worthwhile, and just where he started from. He was one of seven kids who grew up in a one-bedroom flat in a place called Mercer House, which still exists, just off Cup Street.
So off near Stephen's Green there, in Dublin.
Off Stephen's Green, exactly. So not much of a future. Himself and two of his friends could see that even back then. And they decided at 16 years of age to change the date on their birth cert and submit it to the British Army. The Army didn't ask too many questions, and the three of them signed up. And they did basic training in a place called Ballykinler up outside Derry for six weeks. And then they were on a troop ship to North Africa.
Wow.
And they encountered Rommel and all of that, and El Alamein and all the good stuff. And then up the east coast of Italy, or west coast initially, Sicily first, west coast of Italy, and then cut across to Monte Cassino.
And in Italy, yeah. And
in Italy, yeah. And on the east coast of Italy, in the Monte Cassino campaign, they fought alongside a Yugoslav partisan army led by a guy who at the time was known as Michael Broz, who later became known as Tito.
And their lead, he served under Marshal Alexander, Field Marshal Montgomery, and the famous General Mark Clark, the March on Rome.
Yes.
Did he have a view of those three gentlemen?
He had a view of all three. He had huge respect for Mark Clark, Alexander, rather.
Okay.
Both Alexander and Montgomery were Irish or had Irish roots. Alexander's attitude towards any confrontation with the enemy was that you first weighed up the potential cost in human life and wasn't worth it. Montgomery was slightly different. He felt if the objective was absolutely essential, the cost was not really relevant. Whereas Mark Clark's attitude, according to my father, was didn't matter what the cost was in any circumstances. You had an objective and you paid the price.
Mm. And he was regarded as a showman, wasn't he? He wanted the glory to get to Rome first.
One of the reasons the British 8 were diverted towards Monte Cassino because Mark Clark insisted that the American First Army would be the first to liberate the Eternal City.
Okay. Now, there was a nasty episode, which is indicative, unfortunately, of what happened and has been raised already. When these men and women came back from the Second World War. A number of them had been in the Irish Army and deserted. A number of them had been, like, it's amazing, 16-year-olds in 1942 signing up to fight Hitler and changing their date of birth to get them into the army. But when you were in school, what happened?
Yeah, we were talking about, it was 1961-62, and the 50th commemoration, 1966, of the 1916 Rising wasn't too far away. And we were being told stories about that and all that good stuff. And the teacher asked on the day, did we know if any of our parents' relations had been involved in the 1916 Rising? Mm-hmm. And myself and two other three kids put a hand up and said, no, but my daddy was in the British Army during the Second World War. Okay. And the other two or three kids said the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the response of the teacher was, these men were traitors and should never be mentioned again.
Wow. And you heard that when what? You were 8 years of age?
8 years of age, yeah.
But your father was a traitor.
Yeah. Now, in fairness, I'm not going to mention the teacher or the school. The school in general was very, very good. It was excellent. Mm-hmm. But it was just the attitude that was still, it wasn't that unusual at the time. Yeah. It seemed to be fairly well set among certain members of the community at that time.
Okay, now, which brings us to a call we had yesterday about a brother, Colin Bannis. His name was Sean Deegan, born in Usher's Island in the inner city, south inner city, just like Cove Street. Around the same time, as far as I can work out. And he campaigned when he came back for the Irish men and women who fought in the Second World War to be recognised and not to be called traitors, which they were on a number of occasions. And John McNeely has contacted us. John, good afternoon.
Yep.
And John, you interviewed brother Colin Bannis as he was then. Tell us a little bit about how you came across him.
I first came across him, I was watching the 60th ceremonies on Sky and...
Of D-Day, yeah.
Of D-Day in 2004. And so they were, after the ceremonies, they were interviewing some of the veterans, and there was this man in a Franciscan uniform, and obviously stood out from the rest of them. And he opens his mouth, and it's an Irish bloke. And he said, I'm Brother Colin Bannis Deegan from Dublin, and spoke about it, and... What caught my attention was, he said, and we were airbrushed out of history.
Wow.
And I said, that's a pretty, very strong sentiment, and strength thing to say. And so I found out that he was down in the Friary in Waterford, and I actually rang him, and I said, well, could I talk to you, and could I interview and write your story? And and he said, and he was kind of, he was fairly sharp in a lot of ways, and he said, and is this for money? He says to me, and I says, no, I'm not going to get a penny out of this for anyone. And if you want, and I said, if I do get a penny, I can give it to charity. No, he said, that's fine. He says, come down and see me.
Yeah.
So I drove down to Waterford to the Friary, and in my enthusiasm, I was there about 15 minutes in advance of the appointed hour at 2 o'clock. And I rang him, said, listen, I'm here now. Do you want to go with me? He says, I told you 2 o'clock. It'll be 2 o'clock.
Okay.
But I know he was great fun, Joe, and a great guy. And very much anti-war. He had seen a lot.
Yeah. So when did he join? He was born in Usher's Island in Dublin. His parents were James and Anne Deegan. Educated like my own father at North Brunswick Street School around the same time, because my father was born in 26. He was born in 1925, so they might have known each other. And Sean Deegan was. And why did he join the army? And how did he come to join the army for the Second World War?
Yeah, well, I was very curious about this, and he just said it was a sense of adventure. There wasn't much going on in Dublin. Yeah. Young, adventurous, and went for the sense of adventure. And that's basically what he said to me. And he said, and so they took off and went up to Belfast, and then, maybe at that time, or whatever news reports they were getting in Ireland, they kind of joined the RAF and to be a probably a pilot, I'd say, and didn't make the grade type of thing. And there was some sort of air accident, which he didn't really want to talk about. Mm. And I was very sensitive when I was talking to him about bringing up memories. He got a head injury. He ended up in Shotley Bridge Hospital in the northeast of England near Durham. And he was told, listen, we can excuse you out of the service because you've been injured. And he said, no, he said, I want to stay. So they offered him this job of RAF salvage.
Okay.
And he was trained to ride a motorbike, an old BSA type bike, by a Wall of Death rider. Right?
Yeah.
On the beaches around Blackpool. And from that, he was taught how to maintain the bike and everything else. And then he was then designated to go in on Sword Beach, I think, if memory serves me right here now, on D+2.
Okay.
And on D+2, I was asking him, well, what was it like? You know, he said it was just unbelievable, the noise of the initial assault on D-Day itself, the aircraft going overhead, the whole thing. And then they went in on D+2, and his job was to do any downed aircraft what they could salvage to be reused. And
of course,
he said the worst. So the first night there, they kind of dug in beside a bit of a ditch, and next thing a mortar round came in close by, and he said, "And that was my welcome to the war." And then he subsequent to that told me that he was, because the RAF uniform was a kind of a bluish colour, but the dust it got kind of grey. So he said he'd be taking a pot shot at him as he was driving around looking at this. And what he said to me, like, he said he felt a bit like he could go anywhere he wanted. He had a pass to go anywhere he wanted to collect or to see what it could be salvaged from down there.
Okay. Now, remember, in 1944, and you're reminding me, John, he was only 19.
Absolutely. Unbelievable.
Same as his wife had a job.
Wow. Unbelievable, these men, the bravery. Okay, as I mentioned yesterday, I heard a clip of Ryan Tuberty on Virgin, but it's Q103, isn't it? 106 in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned brother Colin Bannon. That's how he came into I'd never heard of him before. And he said that he had interviewed him many years ago. This is an extract from the interview.
We got into Germany, crossed the Rhine, and we found a different aspect altogether, because up to then, we didn't know what. I'd never met a German, and I didn't know what the Germans were like. But they seemed to be normal people. They were hanging out white flags, bringing out glasses of water and so forth. And we thought, God, these are not the monsters that we were led to believe through propaganda, the Germans. Mm. But then we came across, as you say, these awful, brutal camps. And that changed the whole attitude. I remember myself thinking with some of the lads, when you went through these camps, if you met any Germans the other side, it was just their hard luck, because you had no hesitation in the revenge. Do you know what I mean? It's brutalised these people so much that there was just hatred in your heart after that. That was only one camp compared to all the other camps all over the place. The awful labour, the labour camps where they starved them to death. They worked them to death and then starved them. It never gave them enough food, and they were having them working in these munition factories. They were from all the Baltic countries, and they were just living skeletons. You know,
were you surprised at the hate in your heart then? Were you taken aback?
I really was. I couldn't believe that we'd been conned so much, that this had been happening, and that we didn't know really what was happening. We were just fighting battles, you know, and winning wars and all that sort of thing. And all this awful thing was going on unknownst to us, because we'd never heard a word about it. No one had ever heard about Belsen or any of these things previous to them being opened.
And that is brother Colin Bannon's interview there. I think it's 20 years ago by Ryan Tuberty. And then he actually participated, it was 2007. He actually participated he became an anti-war activist. And also he campaigned for men like him, not just himself, but like Brian's father, to be properly recognised and not be called traitors by teachers, John. Was he passionate about that?
Yeah, he was very anti-war, and he strongly protested. He was at the forefront of the war against Iraq and all of that. And then he said, like, it was wrong what was happening here. I mean, I suppose for most of us that were around the 90s, all this sort of came to light through the likes of the works of Richard Doherty, Kevin Myers, Miles Duncan.
Yeah, yeah.
Neil Richardson did a fantastic book called Decent Times, Decent Men. And he said it was wrong to be treated like that. They went, you know, maybe sense of adventure, And then, you know, they went to do what they thought was a decent thing to do. And one thing I always took from the interview with him was he said he had been there. He said to me they had overheard on the radio network about the liberation of Belsen. And so they went. I couldn't believe it. And he said it stayed with him for years afterwards. But he was so anti-war. I mean, you know, I was asking him about the level of destruction, the displaced people, all of this sort of stuff. And he just said it was, it should never happen again. And he was vehemently anti-war. But the treatment by the Irish government, he just found it was unnecessary and it was cruel.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a blacklist and stuff like this. People couldn't get jobs or, you know, stuff like that out of it. And other people left. And well, they've left the country subsequently and went back to England and stuff like that. So, yeah.
And he died.
Joe, if I may come in here.
Yeah, yes, yes. Brian, yes.
Yeah. With regard to my father's experience, and I certainly understand what the other John, participant is saying. John, my father's experience was slightly different in that at the end of the war, they, as I said, he served in Palestine for 2 6-month tours of duty on the policing action, as it was called. But then when he said, I'm not doing any more, they were volunteers at that stage. They said, right, you're going back to Dublin. And he said, yes, I am. And they said, well, we'll help. And they offered him a job. They arranged with Guinness to provide him with a job. And he spent his working career in Guinness then for until he retired. And as a Guinness employee then, he was accommodated with a house, a three-bedroom house in Turin, York. And that's where I spent the first 7 years of my 7 or 8 years of my life there.
That's so interesting, yeah.
The British Army didn't just say thanks and bugger off.
Interesting.
They actually did what they could to support people who come from the Free States.
Well, I'll take a break and then we'll go to Richard Doherty, one of the many great historians, and Kevin Myers has been mentioned, Miles Dungan, Neil Richardson has been mentioned as well, of the Irish involvement in both World Wars, in regard to Kevin Myers, but in World War II in regard to others. Back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Step into summer with our new curtain designs and colours. Explore our latest designs in-store or online.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Richard Doherty, the historian and writer, has written many books about the Second World War and especially the Irish involvement, North and South. Richard, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Really, really appreciate your participation. You've nearly 30 published books to your credit and many, many articles in learned journals. Richard, what was the importance, so to speak, of the Irish people from this island of Ireland in World War II?
Well, they were very important in terms of manpower because there were at least 130,000 volunteers from both sides of the border.
Okay.
Almost equal numbers. The numbers that I've been able to come up with make it slightly more from what is now the Republic than from Northern Ireland.
Okay.
And it's probably even higher than that. So they're a critical part of the manpower that's available to the United Kingdom. And of course, there were Irish born also in the US Army, the Canadian forces, Australian and New Zealand forces. So the very, very large contribution made by Irish men and women during the Second World War.
And then D-Day, Richard, this time 80 years ago, the Irish involvement.
Well, the Irish involvement in D-Day comes right down from the top because the man who commands all the ground troops up until the 1st of September is Bernard Law Montgomery, whose family came from Mobile in County Donegal. And when he was awarded the freedom of the city of Londonderry on the 15th of September 1945, he said to the mayor, who had served under him in 8th Army, he said, I wonder what people will think about me, a free stater, being given the freedom of the city of Londonderry.
That's what it was called, And Richard, casualties?
Casualties were heavy, but in terms of proportions, they weren't any heavier than any other nations. I come across people every now and again who say when things were really difficult, the British sent the Irish in to get killed. Well, I've come across Canadians who say the same thing, that they sent the Canadians in. Yeah. It simply isn't true. Some people, some units and formations had very bad days, and that happened in both world wars. It wasn't a case of these guys were sent in because they were expendable. They were sent in because they were there at the time and they were the next in line, if you like, to go into the jaws of death.
Okay, and then, Richard, the attitude after would it be correct in saying about 6,000 people from the island, between 5,000 and 6,000 were killed in World War II?
It's roughly about that. It's probably closer to the 6,000 mark.
Okay.
Which is a very high proportion those who joined up, and that I know of, and is one of the things that makes me think that the number was actually higher than what I've been able to work out.
Okay, and your level of research, I was reading your book about Ireland in the Second World War, your level of research is so detailed, down to the last one or two, down to individual names that you try and verify left, right, and centre. And Richard, the attitude, Brian there told you when he was in school here in Dublin, the teacher said, when he said, my dad fought in the Second World War, he said, well, the number of lads in the class, and the teacher said to 8-year-olds, they were traitors. What is the attitude when these men came back? And I presume it differed in the north and the south, did it? And even differed between communities.
I think it was different. Obviously, I'm not aware because I was brought up in Northern Ireland, but I have cousins, many cousins who live in the Republic, Donegal particularly, mm-hmm. and in Dundalk and elsewhere. But I knew some of the guys. There were about 4,000 who deserted from the Defence Forces and joined the UK Forces, who were then blacklisted, so they couldn't get any jobs in local government jobs or what have you. And that, and stigma is the wrong word, but it's the word that comes to mind, that seemed to adhere to some of the guys who simply had come back without having been ever in the Defence Forces. But against that, a number of years ago, and I'm talking about 30-odd years ago, okay. was told by the late Eamon Crowe that the largest Remembrance Sunday parade anywhere on the island of Ireland up until 1969 was in the city of Limerick.
Okay.
And I made that comment in a talk to the Northern Ireland Royal British Legion annual general meeting in 2015, and a gentleman came up to me afterwards and he said, I'm from Limerick and I can tell you that we still have the largest Remembrance Sunday parade anywhere on the island.
Fascinating. And do you think the attitude has changed with time?
I think the attitude has changed. There's more willingness to recognise that the men and the women who went across the water or across the border to join up in the UK forces were doing something that was noble. We're very fond, and we have been very fond for years, of using the term peace with justice in Ireland. Actually, the first use I can find of that phrase was Pius XII describing what the Allies were doing during the Second World War. And he used it in an audience with Irish soldiers and Irish airmen and Irish sailors in the Vatican, specially arranged on the 12th of June, 1944. That's almost 80 years ago to the day. And my father was there.
And I met a pal of mine this morning, Pat Keegan, who's from City Quay in Dublin, and his father was there as well. His father was and he had the audience with Pope Pius. And in fact, it made such an impact on his father, William, that one of his brothers was christened William Pius. I don't know whether there was a few Piuses in Dublin at the time. But anyway, it's an incredible story of the minesweepers, and one particular man Percy, who Cunningham, who was awarded the Military Cross. They cleared the beaches on D-Day of mines with their bare hands.
Well, no, there were people who prodded with for mines. There were also the guys who used what were called Polish detectors, which were handheld things that looked a bit like a vacuum cleaner. But Percy Sutton is the man you're talking about. Percy Sutton was an officer in the Westminster Dragoons, and they used Sherman tanks that had been specially modified. And if you can imagine a tank with two huge metal jibs jutting out from the front and above, and between the jibs, there's a roller. And from the roller are suspended very heavy lengths of chain.
Okay.
As the tank moves forward, the roller rotates and the chain literally bashes and thrashes the earth and sets off mines. So those tanks were modified Shermans. They were known as flail tanks and nicknamed crabs. And they would beat paths through the minefields for other tanks to follow and for infantry to follow as well. Percy Sutton's job was as a troop commander, so he had a small number of tanks under him. He did that job under heavy fire from machine guns, mm-hmm. mortars, and field guns on the 6th of June and on the 7th of June, where his men were harboured, as the military expression, in other words, where they were stopped and preparing for the next phase. They were attacked by German infantry with German field guns opened up on them from a very, very short distance, less than a quarter of a mile away. Percy himself was shot in the thigh as he got down from his tank, and it literally was a hand-to-hand action at one point. But they not only beat the Germans off, but they captured 100 of them, and they took several of the German guns that had been used on them. So for that, his operations over those 2 days, Percy Sutton was awarded the Military Cross.
Incredible. Say with us, Richard. By the way, if you just Google Richard Doherty, historian Richard Doherty books, I guarantee such is the range. Well, especially if you're interested in, which a lot of us are, in the Second World War, such is the range of what Richard has written, that one of them is going to jump out, they all might, but one of them in particular is going to be it on Churchill or the Eighth Army in Italy or El Alamein or Montecito. Have a look there. By the way, John McNeely, I know you, when you met Brother Colin Bannis, the Franciscan padre, formerly Sean mm-hmm. Deegan, you actually had a tape recorder with you. This is a small extract of Brother Colin Bannis talking to our John McNeely.
When we came in, we weren't to land with the forces because we were non-combatant. You know, we were waiting until they weren't going to send in everything all at once until they got the thing was cleared. So eventually when their turn came out, but you had to keep down because they were firing, the big ships behind us were firing inland. The Renowned was behind us, a huge battleship about a mile or two behind us. And that was firing shells. And you can even see the shells going over. You can see it. You could feel the wind of them and the big shadow. Shoom, and then you'd wait.
Wow. And that is the late brother, Colin Bannis. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Lorraine Leonard is in Santry in Dublin. It was your father, Tim Conlon, originally from Bath Avenue here near Ringsend. He joined the Inniskillen Fusiliers. Where did he serve, okay. Lorraine?
He served in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and was captured in Italy.
And did he ever talk about it?
Very seldom. There's bits of the stories going around. Like five sons, he obviously spoke to them about a bit more than what he would with his daughters. So we got the, PG version, as you could say, of the stories. But yeah, my brothers probably heard a little bit more, but he wasn't talkative as such. Later on in life, when I tried to ask him about it, he kind of switched off from it. He didn't want to really get into it, you know.
But he was captured by the Germans in Italy and transferred.
He was
transferred to a prisoner of war camp.
Wow. He was sent to a transit camp near Rome, which was in Farisabina. It was called 54, And then that camp was emptied out and they were all put on this very, very long, slow-moving train being sent to prisoner of war camps in Germany when the Americans bombed the train. So
wow.
He escaped. He stayed behind German lines. He was never caught. And when the Allies liberated Rome on the 4th of June, I believe, 1944, is when he started making his way back down towards Rome. And he eventually got into the Vatican, got talking to a priest. The priest was able to send a message to his old landlady in Birmingham, who got word to his mother that he was alive and well.
Incredible.
On the same day that my mother got a letter to say Tim is missing, presumed dead, you can now collect the widow's pension. So the two letters arrived the same day.
Isn't that incredible?
So, yeah, so it was a story that we kind of knew about.
Yeah.
I knew that there was a fire on a train and he escaped from the fire and he was behind German lines at the time and he stayed, you know, behind those lines trying to, you know, scavenge food and whatever else. And so I'd heard those stories, but the detail I didn't know about until a few years ago when I was watching the documentary. I happened to Google his name again just to see if something came up.
Okay.
And lo and behold, this book by a woman called Jeanette Kinraid, she'd written about the Bridge of Arona, and my father's testimony was in among other, you know,
well
hundreds
done.
Of testimony in the book.
Well
yeah.
done, Lorraine.
So try to find out more, but I'd say there's a bit of a podcast in the whole thing. I can't find out what was going on during the escape years, but look, you know.
You've done incredible. You've done incredible research.
Yeah. I'd need a Richard.
Yeah, I know. I'll have a look at Richard's, the books that Richard has. And by the way, there's a good number of experts, but Richard is, he's meticulous in his attempts to identify names, specific names of Irish men or men from the island and women from the island of Ireland.
Well, we've tried to get more information through relatives in Birmingham and that have contacts in Cuve that do research for family stuff. And I've found very little more than what Jeanette had uncovered during her research for the book. So, it would be nice to get more detail because he gave plenty of... He was obviously questioned in September 1944 about the whole incident and episode. Yeah. So there's information somewhere.
And how did he get on when he came back to Ireland?
He was back in Ireland. I think he had a job kind of in Raleigh and then he went back to go to Japan, which he went to Japan then and as part of the Allied forces out there. And then he came back from Japan and he was working, I think, in Cadbury's, and then he got a call up to go to the Korean War, which he went off out for that one. And when he came back, he was finding it hard to get jobs. So eventually he got a job where an old, I think, CEO from his Second World War days was working in the same place or was a manager there or something. So he got into Standard Life Assurance when he was there until he retired.
But was he shunned when he came back, do you think?
I don't think my father was the type of person that would allow himself to be shunned.
He was a real gentle
person. He didn't encourage us to speak about his time, for obvious reasons. I'm the youngest, so I was only sort of growing up in the late 60s, 70s when the Troubles were starting. So we weren't really encouraged to discuss the fact that he was in the British Army at any point in his life.
Okay.
At the same time, he didn't hide it if someone said it to him. And you could see... There was a lot of men. I mean, we lived in Finglas East, and you could see that when the men were trotting down to the shops or going out for little messages, you could see the World War II men standing around at the wall and having their little chat quietly.
Fascinating, yeah.
You know what I mean? So there was plenty even on our road that served.
And he passed away in 2009, 90, just before his 94th birthday. What an incredible man. What an incredible hero. And well, keep digging, Lorraine. Keep getting. You will get more information. And thanks to all our contributors today and indeed this week about D-Day. It's much closer to Irish people than I think a lot of people, including myself, realise. Okay, before we go... and sound Chris O'Connor, broadcast coordinator Shane Gavin, producer Tara Lockrigan, series producer Annette Egan. Angela, are you there, Angela? Quickly.
I am indeed, Joe.
You were with us on Monday. Your camper van, your darling camper van, your love boat had been destroyed on the road.
It was destroyed.
On the road through Sligo by, you didn't know what the materiel was, but you couldn't get it off your camper van. And and then you thought Sligo originally said no, we didn't get any complaints, and then they came back and said Angela is telling the absolute truth. What's happened to your van in the meantime?
Well, in the meantime now, 5S, a company car-velleting in Mallow,
yes,
they've done it for me, and they've done a fantastic job, and it looks amazing.
Okay, and who it's €450, who pays?
Would you believe it now, Michael from Colas, who was very good, and he sorted it out for me.
And they are the contractor for transport infrastructure.
I got my money back, so I'm delighted.
Okay, well done. Well done, Angela. Thanks indeed. Back on Monday. Catherine Thomas is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Step into summer with our new curtain designs and colours. Explore our latest designs in-store or online.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.